This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, our own Heidi Bogosian observes the 30-year anniversary of the violent Tompkins Square Park riots. We're joined by East Village community activist Susan Howard, photographer Joseph McBride, and East Village writer Arthur Nersessian. We learn about the pre-riot gentrification resistance of the Lower East Side and hear rare first-hand accounts of the heavy-handed police violence where the blame was ultimately placed on the NYPD for inciting a riot.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Bogosian. 35 years ago, a singular event occurred in Manhattan's East Village that would prove transformative to many lives for years to come. Today on Law and Disorder, we bring you a special program on the August 1988 Tompkins Square Park police riot, as recounted by several individuals who were there for the entire event. We share firsthand observations of unbridled police violence. We talk about how we came to be there. And we discuss how the riot marked the linchpin in transforming an entire neighborhood from a mecca of creativity and political activism to the new home of Target, Starbucks, and other hallmarks of American gentrification. Tompkins Square Park is bounded on the west and east by Avenues A and B, and on the north and south by 10th and 7th Streets. It falls in the part of that neighborhood often referred to as Alphabet City, named for the four alphabet-numbered avenues that in the 1960s and 70s were a center of drug trade, squatters, and a large Puerto Rican community. The park had a history of activism, as it was the site of a riot in 1874 on behalf of the city's labor movement.
Well, during that period, in the mid to late 80s, there was a huge wave of gentrification on the Lower East Side. The Cristo d'Oro had been renovated into luxury housing. The squats, at that time, there were very many. They were being evicted. There were constant struggles to keep people in their homes, in those buildings. And there was a phone bank to bring activists out to demonstrations to support those efforts. It was Eviction Watch.
Lower East Side community activist Susan Howard recalls her experiences that night.
We heard that the park was going to be closed. At that time, it was a hub of activity. People were meeting there. There was a band shell. There was daily music, bands, organizing, punks. There was a big drug trade in the neighborhood. And the community board and some of the more wealthy neighbors wanted to shut that down. So we heard, and the police put up signs that they were going to enforce a curfew and gave a date when that curfew would begin. And so the call went out to meet that night at the park. I got there around 8 o'clock, and people were gathering. There was a march around the park, inside the park, and there was a constant call of a conch shell, calling people to the park, calling people to the demonstration. The constant phrase was, pigs out of the park, pigs out of the park. That's what everyone was chanting. And as the police came into the park, they started pushing people out, and they pushed us out on Avenue A at 8th Street. And they pushed us out of the park and they barricaded the park. At that time, we saw mounted police, which were down at 10th Street and Avenue A. And the mounted police rushed the crowd, picking up someone by their hair, dragging people down the street, and trying to push us away from the park. Some people ran up 8th Street. The majority ran down Avenue A towards 6th Street, and they barricaded Avenue A at 6th Street, and that became the standoff location.
My name is Arthur Nersessian. I was on my rooftop on, I guess, roughly the corner of 4th Street and 1st Avenue that night. It was a warm night, and even though we saw posters that something was happening at the park, we kind of, you know, decided we were all in our 20s and we were just kind of hanging out and having beers. And let's see, among people there, I remember Lisa Raven, who later went on to make a pretty decent film. Anyway, we're standing there and we started hearing stuff in the distance, because you look down First Avenue, it's kind of a valley, and we heard some kind of ruckus going on, but we kind of ignored it. And basically the thing that really triggered everything for us was suddenly this helicopter came in low and swooped over the houses. It kind of circled once, and then a spotlight came on, a really bright spotlight, and started covering the rooftops. And we were like, what the heck is this? And I think it made some kind of announcement, like, get off the roof, get off the roof. And I'll, to this day, I mean, 30 years, I still remember how bright that spotlight was. And we were like, what is, you know, did somebody just shoot the president from up here? Anyway, this is the irony. We probably would have just ignored the whole thing, but because of this crazy, you know, police copter, we basically said, well, we got to see what's going on, you know, which is, I'm sure, exactly what they did not want you to do. So that, you know, just shows you how they draw you in. So we go downstairs, and I think some of us broke up, but me and my brother went through the Village View, which is a housing complex that kind of borders 6th Street with, I guess, 4th Street, and then up between 1st and A. And it has several entrances and exits, so you can kind of permeate the avenue without going down any clear shots of the street, which they kind of capped off. And I remember hearing screaming and people running away from us, and we were going into it, which is foolish, but we were young. And I think I remember we cut up between 1st and A, and I saw a cop kind of swinging his baton, you know, club, hitting people as they were running. And I thought, well, I didn't do anything wrong. I don't see anything wrong. So I kind of naively went up and said, what's going on? What's going on? And I believe I got whacked on the wrist, and it wasn't, you know, I had like this walnut-sized bruise that lasted a while that people noticed. And that was my recollection of the Tompkins Square riots. And, you know, again, no clue, and run into it by the police. And anyway, and I guess the punchline is, if you see a crazy man swinging a club, no matter what he's wearing, you should turn and run the other way. The notion that he's wearing a police uniform is not going to save you. So that was what I took away from that.
I found out later that the person who had been beaten and laying in the street was a travel writer who had been trying to catch a cab. And I found that out because a friend who was a playwright wrote a play about the Tompkins Square Park riot in 1998 called Pipe Bomb Sonata. And he had actually done research and found the person and spoke to him. And he remembered that incident very clearly. Later in that evening, as the police continued to rush the crowd, there were still plenty of people on the street.
The night of the riot, I was in my apartment. I'm a photographer. At that time, I was about 21. I didn't have a lot of money, so I used to shoot a lot of stuff in the street because I couldn't afford studios and things like that.
John McBride was a photographer.
I used to shoot a lot of police activity, and that night, I heard police sirens, and then more police sirens, and more police sirens, and I was about, I guess, 7 blocks away. I lived on Suffolk, a block below Houston. So finally, I decided I better throw my camera stuff in my bag and get out there and at least see what was going on, because something seemed to be happening. And I sort of ran out the door, I forgot my flash, and went up Avenue A, and I could tell there was something definitely going on, and I got closer and closer, and eventually I arrived on Avenue A between 5th and 6th. There was a huge crowd of people. It was really, really hot, tons of cops. There was a battle line already drawn across 6th Street and A, and the cops were north of 6th Street. They had a line formed and cops on horses behind them, and there were protesters south of Avenue A. There was a van parked on Avenue A on the side, and I could see there was a videographer up there. And that was obviously the vantage point, and that's where I wanted to be to take pictures. So I decided to get up on the van. That's when I realized I didn't have my flash. And so I took some handheld pictures from the van, which ended up getting published in the Village Voice. And I took other pictures during the riot where I, you know, there's a little trick you can do. You can keep your shutter open when there are other photographers shooting flash, and you can kind of steal their flashes as they hit the subject. And so that's what I did with the flash pictures from that night. It's not even my flash. So essentially, the people who were at the front of the line were sort of like trying to do like a sit-in in the streets, trying to sit peacefully and not be moved. The people behind them were sort of, you know, protesting or observing, milling around, and then once in a while somebody from the back would sort of duck behind someone, reach into a bag, and then throw a bottle up in the air to come down at the police. Sometimes this would cause the police to just dodge out of the way, but at a specific time this happened and the police decided to charge the crowd. So they charged the crowd and pushed the crowd south down Avenue A. And all of a sudden, before I was on the protester side, and it was clear from where we were, the cops had a clear view of us. It was clear that there were only a couple of us up there, two or three up there, and it was clear that we weren't throwing anything because they could see us extremely well. So that was sort of, and it was clear that we were shooting photos and videos. It was clear that what we were doing was simply press type, photojournalism type activity. And the next minute, the police line rushed past us, chasing protesters down the street. And I was in cop territory at that point. And there was a cop who, I guess, was perhaps not too happy that he didn't have any protesters to chase because he wasn't at the front of the line, and started swinging the nightstick at us.
They saw a videographer on top of a van shooting, and the police came on either side of the van, and they started swinging their billy clubs.
It came pretty clear to me that that was not the right side of the van to get down on, because this guy was completely out of control and wanted to hurt us. I pivoted around to the other side, and while he was swinging the stick, I was jumping backwards so that the stick was just swishing by right in front of my shins.
I watched him jump up and down, trying to avoid getting hit by the billy clubs, and it was actually comical from where I was standing because it was so absurd.
And then I decided to pivot, turn around, and the stick caught me on the inside of my leg, hit me real hard, and there was another cop on the other side, and he just kind of motioned like, you know, get down. So that was obviously the safer place to go. So I jumped down from there.
I was surprised to see the police had covered their badge numbers with black tape, clearly trying to conceal their identities and to stop any documentation of what was going on.
Although at the time I didn't yet know Susan Howard, whom I've come to work with over the past 15 years, through the National Lawyers Guild and other community activism, it turned out we were standing just a few feet from one another by sidewalks. Through my work with the East Villager newspaper, I ran into several journalists, a few from other countries who happened to be there and were sitting at tables at the cafe. All of a sudden, I noticed that a young police officer standing kitty-corner from me was looking at me and raising his billy club. I started to run. I was wearing, I remember, a long cotton skirt. And I ran eastward on 6th Street. And to my left, I saw about three or four people frantically buzzing at the door of one of the tenement buildings a few doors in from Sidewalk Cafe. So I made a beeline to them. The officer was now running full speed at all of us. We burst through the door as the buzzer sounded and ran up a narrow flight of stairs to a first floor apartment where a stranger to me let us in, and I promptly ran and hid in the closet. We could hear that officer smashing his nightstick on the door, I guess below. I'm not sure if he made it into the building, but I was terrified at that point.
And when they backed us up to 6th Street, more people came. The conch shell went off and more people came. There were hundreds of people in the street. And there were hundreds of police, and it was clear that there was going to be a standoff. But at some point, the police started rushing the crowd. And when they would rush the crowd, they would pull out their batons, and they would beat people. And they would knock them down, and they would hit them again, and there were bloodied people all over the street. And that continued to happen all night. I was witness to one man. He was clearly walking through the neighborhood, standing at 6th and A. I said to him he should move. He should get ready to move. He stood there. We ran down the street, and when I came back, he was in the middle of the street with a bloodied head, and I had to convince him to get into an ambulance. I went into 7A. They let me use the phone. They were the only restaurant that stayed open during the riot, and we all used that space to either hide, make phone calls, because there were no cell phones at the time, or to take refuge.
Initially, you know, after the wrist whacking, you know, of course we're not going to avoid this. This is something. I was born and raised in New York City, and whenever there's a siren, that to me was, you know, street entertainment. You had to catch every bit of it. So, but with that said, you know, we're not, you know, I'm not crazy, so I'm not going to go try to. I'm not going to get whacked again. So, you know, we kind of ran and caught up with other people and kind of pieced together. And we started seeing, you know, bloody drops and stuff like that and screaming. And, you know, it was a mixture of alcohol and thrill and excitement and fear, you know, depending on who and what you saw. And we started, you know, as we started, you know, and we as we started kind of piecing all this together, what was going on, we were like, oh my God, that little protest. Because we knew they were going to close the park, and we knew they were going to remodel it. And we kind of, you know, we kind of figured, well, this is, you know, bound to happen. And, but we didn't really see the ramifications until that night. And we didn't, you know, and then of course there was all this controversy as to, you know, was it provoked? Because obviously the cops' narrative was that it was, they were booby trapped and it was turned on them. And but for the rest of the evening, it basically was just kind of bouncing around and trying to figure out what was what, and, you know, and witness as much as we could. So,
and eventually the cops pulled back, reformed their line. The protesters reformed the line where they were, I think. But that was sort of, you know, probably after that time, you know, cops were just coming from everywhere. I think they put out some sort of citywide assist call. I think cops were probably coming out of the subways from different boroughs. You know, I think there were cops that didn't have badges. I think there were cops that had black bands that were using them strategically to hide their badge numbers. And some of them just wanted to stand in the line and take orders from whoever their commanding officer was. And some of them seemed happy to just sort of let loose and chase people down and beat them. And at one point, there was a helicopter showed up, and it was obviously not just for observation, but it was obviously some sort of psychological warfare, because the copter came down really low. I remember on First Avenue, the sound, you know, it's very intimidating if you're a protester or a citizen, and so the rotors were blowing the wind real hard and blowing the dust around, getting in your eyes, and The sounds is very, you know, it's not a normal thing you experience. And that's pretty much the beginning of my engagement with these protests in the neighborhood. I actually wasn't even aware that there was going to be a protest that night. I sort of came upon it. And from that point on, I did a lot of photography of the subsequent protests and rallies and squatter evictions and that sort of thing. I don't pretend to be an expert on the issues, but I was a photographer. I was young. I wanted to run around and I wanted to do this, and that's what I did.
Ultimately, I went back downstairs and ventured out. I think this was around 3 in the morning. And subsequently, I did file a complaint among about 100 others with the Civilian Complaint Review Board. The problem, of course, being because the officer's badge number was blackened out, I couldn't really give them the evidence they needed to find out who it was. But it would turn out many years later that a lot of people I knew had actually been hovering around on that corner, as frightened as I was.
Yeah, I remember that, and I remember running down that street as well. I only got to a vestibule with several other people, and we waited for the police to recede, and then we came back out. It was an extremely hot night. It was a dog day in August. I was wearing mostly leather, like many people in the crowd, and it didn't really matter because we were used to wearing leather in the summer. And the atmosphere was intense. I was nervous. I had so much adrenaline going through my body that at 4 a.m. I was wide awake, and I could hear the conch shell going off again and the helicopters hovering above. And no one wanted to leave because the violence and the onslaught of the police was so intense, and people had been assaulted and were beaten and bleeding. We just could not believe that this was happening. People started turning over trash cans and setting them on fire, trying to stop the police from attacking, from continuously running at the crowd and beating them. And we wondered how much longer they were going to stay.
It definitely felt like an invasion, a takeover of our small community. And it was a very tight-knit community at the time. There were a lot of storefront art galleries, performance spaces. As you said, Susan, a lot of mom-and-pop businesses that have long since been gone. For me, what was really frightening was seeing officers so completely out of control. It wasn't really in response to activists' and bystanders' actions. It was more they were unleashing their own frenzy. Who knows why? I hear that a lot of them came from other precincts, although they were under the control of the 9th precinct. But I feel as though they came into our neighborhood and went wild.
Yeah, I think they really disliked the culture that was in the community. They really didn't like punks. They really didn't like squatters. They didn't like crusties. They didn't like homeless people. They didn't like art punks. This was not the group of people that they thought were proper citizens. And they treated us. They treated us like we were vermin. Cops would push me from behind. They would call me names. They treated me as if I didn't deserve respect, that I had no reason to protest, and that they didn't want us there. They wanted us gone, and they thought if they could just attack us and brutalize us that we would leave. But we were so used to that kind of treatment in the neighborhood that we stood our ground. And we were the ones still standing when the police left. We managed to stay until they left. And then later on, days later, there was another protest where some in the neighborhood really fought back and became very violent towards the police. And that conflict went on for over a year on and off.
Oh. blacks with knives and whites with clubs, fighting at Howl Beach. There's no such thing as human rights when you walk the New York streets. A cop was shot in the head by a 10-year-old kid named Boot in Central Park last week. The fathers and daughters lined up by the coffins by the statue of bigotry. Hey, you better hold on. Something happening here. You better hold on. Well, I'll meet you at Tompkins Square. The dopey sent a message to the cops last week and they shot him in the car where he sat. And Eleanor Bumpus and Michael Stewart must have appreciated that. There's a rampaging rage rising up like a plague of bloody violence washing up on the beach. It'll take more than the Angels, the Iron Mike Tyson to heal this bloody breach. Hey, hey, you better hold on. Or something's happening here. You better hold on. I'm gonna meet you in Tompkins Square. A junkie ran down a lady, a pregnant dancer. She'll never dance, but the baby was saved. He shot up some China white and nodded out at the wheel, and he doesn't remember a thing. They shot that old lady cause they thought she was a witness to a crime she didn't even see. Whose home is the home of the brave by the statue of bigotry. Hey, better hold on. Or something's happening here. You better hold on. There's a riot in Tompkins Square. You got a black 38 and a gravity knife. You still have to ride the train. There's the smelly essence of New York down there, but you ain't no Bernard Goetz. There's no mafia lawyer to fight in your corner for that 15 minutes of fame. The have and have nots are bleeding in the tub. That's New York's future, not mine. Oh, you better hold on. Or something's happening here. You better hold on. If ever something's happening here.
At that time, Avenue A had very few restaurants. There were a couple of local favorites, 7A, The Sidewalk, and Binny's Burritos had just opened up, and there were huge protests about it opening up in the neighborhood because it was a chain. It was very dark. There were many small businesses, lots of mom-and-pop stores, still juvenile furniture stores, that was the district at the time, many Polish restaurants. It was a real neighborhood. It was a real community.
Look, I was born and raised in New York City, and I had been, we lived on 16th and 3rd Avenue. In fairness, the East Village was a pretty dangerous and rough area. I mean, I remember the Rubicon was kind of Broadway. You kind of went west of Broadway, but, you know, we would still slowly kind of make inroads into the area as things started changing. But it was kind of regarded as a free zone. I mean, I remember when hookers used to come up above 14th, the cops would just stop them and say, go below 14th. And it was kind of regarded, you know, you could sell drugs. You could, you know, you could get hooked. You could do anything you wanted. I think I remember reading that the cops referred to the area as evil. And, you know, basically it was just kind of this free zone that they realized they just could not police. I mean, especially back then when it was back in the day. And, you know, in fairness, at that point, everybody you knew had been mugged or burgled or had some kind of incident happen. I mean, I had a friend who lived on Fifth Street who used to pretend to have multiple sclerosis. She used to kind of walk with a drag on her leg and her hand bad so that they would not harass her. So it was a rough area. You know, it really was. And, you know, what they kind of leave out is that you paid your rent by just kind of dealing with that stuff. The landlords were completely unattentive. I remember when I moved into my apartment, the former tenants' clothing and furniture was still there. I mean, you know, they didn't. The super didn't even come and clean the place out. Now they do a complete gut renovation and they, you know, they triple the rent. But back then it was like, here's the keys. It was like more like going into a rooming house where the last person had just hung himself or something. So, and every building had, you know, mouse and roach infestation. Usually rats in the basement. I mean, you know, mine does. And because my apartment is one of the last unrenovated apartments, I still get them. No one of the other tenants do, but they're all paying like 3-4 times the price that I am.
I'd been living in, I mean, around Manhattan, different places, but my first neighborhood in 1986 that I lived in was 10th Street between B and C, which, that was a totally different world at that time. You know, there were still many vacant, you know, buildings, you know, windows open, just totally crumbling, not renovated yet, not occupied, and maybe burnt, maybe had been burned out, maybe not, or the roof caved in, or maybe not, and maybe shooting galleries, you know, maybe not, homeless people living in them, and some of these buildings were the ones that were taken over by people as makeshift homes, and, you know, they became known as the squatters, and, you know, a lot of these people were involved in these protests against the city, trying to clear people out of these buildings and have the city institute the sort of program that they were used to, which was a typical, you know, renovation of an empty building instead of, I guess, for the city, a much more complicated situation of having people who were in there without permission, where the building might have been dangerous and the city angry, perhaps, that they didn't give permission and feeling perhaps responsible for whatever happened if the building caved in on these people because the city would be liable. So I guess for the city, it was a very messy situation. And they, you know, they clearly took a position that the squatters had to be removed. And that's what they tried to do. I'm not an expert on the whole history of that, but that seems to be, you know, what the breaking point that caused all these demonstrations, which led to what a number of people call, you know, not just a riot, but a police riot.
The point is, that was the neighborhood, and those were the rules. Those were the kind of the way that was the game. You went in there and it was cheap, but you had to deal with that, and you had to deal with all that came with it. And it created this wonderful creativity, this wonderful freedom. Like, no one's watching us. We're kind of write-offs. We could do what we want. And it gave rise to this terrific, I mean, there's no other community in the city, country, or for my, you know, for that matter, in my mind, the world, that had a literary movement. And we had like two or three different little literary magazines. I was managing editor of the Portable Lower East Side, which we got like funding from the NEA and NISCA. We actually got defunded. Anyway, the Between B and C, which had wonderful things. There were all these little venues also, you know, Neither Nor, and some that still exist, I guess, ABC, Norio, and on. And later the New Yorican, and I guess up till recently, the Bowery Poetry Club. I mean, what other neighborhood has all this? And I'm not even going into like their little film movements, and the off Broadway theater, the little theater row on Fourth Street, just theater after theater after theater, where you could write something and get it produced and put it on, and you really felt like, you know, you're in this little world of its own with its own little rules, and it was cheap and affordable and run down and kind of dangerous a little bit. But, you know, on any given night, you go to the, you know, St. Mark's poetry, you know, readings, or you can go to any of these plays, and that's the thing, you'd walk in the area and you got to know the other people. I back then, I could walk down a street on any given day and meet a half a dozen people and say hi. There was a community, there was a sense of community, and this guy was an artist, and that, you know, she was an actor, and he was a writer, and you really felt like it was perfectly fertile soil for being an artist of some kind. And it was, again, cheap, affordable, and the fact that it was run down and a little bit dangerous is what actually kept it affordable, you know, and kept it kind of real. And if you really believed in your art or something, you know, you were willing to make the sacrifice.
I mean, you had everything from vacant buildings with homeless people living in it to immigrant families that had lived there for, you know, for generations, of different ethnicities. And you had people coming in who often had a little bit more money, but not always, who were interested in creating an artistic community. And some of this artwork was created by squatters and created in squats, some of it not. And there were little galleries that had been opened up, and there was a lot of music going on, and it was already hard to get housing you could afford if you didn't have a good job. But there were a lot of things to do, and a lot of Ukrainian and Polish delis where you could get affordable food. it was a place that was very dynamic and fascinating, and you could make a life for yourself. It might not have always been safe. It might not have always been clean. It was certainly a different place at that time.
That was what we lost. That's what Tompkins Square Park represented to me. They were creating a park for the future. They were creating a park for the that was basically an NYU dormitory, mating area. And I didn't know it at the time. I didn't realize the ramifications. I had no idea that capitalism was going to turn this kind of wonderful little area into basically this kind of drone breeding grounds, mating and dormitory for like these revolving door people that stay as long as they go to college and kind of are ready to move on to start families in the suburbs, because there's no community there anymore, and all that stuff has been wiped out. And I'm not even talking about all the wonderful little shops and the vast array of cuisines and little restaurants, Indian Row and Eastern European restaurants. On any given evening, you could go out and for like $3.50, $4 have a wonderful entree, and it was so cheap and affordable and really tasty stuff and good and with variety and all in this tight little area. The whole world was in this kind of 15-minute range of walking, because the area was turning. That's the thing to keep in mind, and it was attracting people. And it's kind of like the banker who wants to live next door to the artist. So what happens? The price. The banker means well. He's not necessarily a bad guy. There's nothing wrong with the banker, but suddenly they realize this guy's a banker. So the cost of living goes up, the rent goes up, and the artist finally moves out because the banker's like, it's just a small amount more for me. That's what happened to this entire area, and now it's kind of gone.
After the riot, over 100 complaints of police brutality were filed with New York's Civilian Complaint Review Board. In the media, blame was attributed to poor police handling and the commander of the 9th Precinct in charge, who was deprived of his office for a year. The New York Times published an editorial titled, "Yes, a Police Riot," and praised then-Police Commissioner Benjamin Ward for the police department's candor in a report they issued confirming what worldwide photographers and journalists and community residents already knew. Community Board Number 3 held a number of really emotional, fired-up, volatile meetings dealing with what had happened.
And their result was that they closed the park for over a year, as they claimed they wanted to renovate it. They demolished the band shell, and they enforced the curfew. Years later, I was at the Manhattan South Police Precinct, the 13th Precinct, which was the command center of the Manhattan South Task Force that policed all the demonstrations. And I was not surprised to see in their meeting room a sign of Tompkins Square Park.
Two police officers were charged with using excessive force that night. Officer Karen Connolly was accused of using her nightstick, quote, wrongfully and without just cause, to strike a civilian. Philip O'Reilly, who was accused of interfering with New York Times photographer Angel Franco and of using his nightstick to injure Franco's head. The CCRB recommended the officers be charged, and Commissioner Ward endorsed that recommendation. The officers were tried before the city's Office of Administrative Trials and Hearings, and the office recommended that charges against O'Reilly be dismissed, while recommending that Connolly's employment be terminated. In the months and years following the riot, the pace of neighborhood gentrification quickened.
After the first night of the riots, I started to follow this issue and these events, and I began shooting and submitting my photographs to Heidi at the East Villager, and she published quite a number of them, squatter evictions, protests, police actions, and so that was a way that, I could at least make my small contribution, I guess, and help document, at least one perspective of what was happening. There were a lot of difficult things going on at the time, but I'm really glad that I was there to take these photographs. I hope they helped people in some way. You know, many people who were there can see themselves in these photographs, and they're online at my website at johnmcbridephotography.com. Hopefully it'll be something that really helps future generations at least have some idea of something important that happened.
I mean, before the riots, I had finished my first novel, The F-Up, and which later went on to become republished by MTV Books, sold 120,000 copies. and it didn't get made into a film, but its sequel got it made into a film with Gina Gershon, and I forgot the other actress. But anyway, it was named My Dead Boyfriend, if anyone wants to look it up. But anyway, after that, I was kind of moved by the whole thing to come out with a chapbook of poetry, kind of prose poems that kind of dealt with it. And here's one of them in which I tried to capture all the forces and the situations that led to it and came out of it. The Tompkins Square Cycle. Number one, an archetype. A tribe in New Guinea has an unusual way of finding its spring sacrifices. They still practice this today. No volunteers are requested, but all the warriors meet on an empty field and huddle in a loose pack, probably motivated as much by the zeal of witnessing violence and the collective might as celebrating fertility and the religious rite. Certain designated warriors ride among the fray on horsebacks and hurl dull-tipped spears randomly all day. Soon the event becomes frenzied, and when one of the spears imperils a warrior, the gods are paid, the event curtailed, the sacrifice made. Long after the riot, among those made aware, behind central booking bars, in a gurney or wheelchair, they might have all thought, shit, we paid much more, but could have each answered differently if asked about what for. That was the first part. Okay, part two, police strategy. After the cavalry and chopper and the wounded were taken away, people shocked, angry, curious, returned to Avenue A. Between 6th Street and 5th Street, they began to rally, swarm, and rant. Then someone would toss a bottle, and the crowd would retreat, recant. The police's turn came, advance, clearing the avenue down to 5th Street and pushing the mob to Avenue B and 1st again. Then it was their turn to retreat to 1st position along Avenue A and 6th Street, a Tompkins Square dance. Slowly, timidly, protesters would return to the front line, and gradually the pot would boil again, and someone from behind would throw a bottle into the garrison. That became the all-night continuum. Subsequent riots took more nerve. They encircled the crowd, undercover boys, busloads of reserves, and once the leaders were quickly shanghaied, they learned you just had spectators along for the ride. And then number three, pendulum swings. After the mid-70s, when the city came to the bankrupt extremity due to years of mismanagement, Lindsay's self-aggrandizement beams in activity. Koch and his early craft set the pendulum the other way. But like every dog, real estate developer, banker, landlord had their day. They waited and aided for what incentives enticed. Yuppie crusades, an eventual housing crisis, relaxed, reckless, slightly suicidal, out of touch, artistically idle, once components that made the East Village soon attracted those who would pillage. From parents to dorms to renovated flats, destabilized apartments that once had rats. Initially, they performed certain duties. They filled the coffers and made big booties. And by the early 80s, they saw their own debts and the epidemic of illegal sublets. Landlords hiked rents to the great outback. And longtime families, Puerto Rican, black, whose rundown apartments were rent-controlled, didn't suspect they lived in gold. For nickels and dimes and evacuation, the later ones collapsed to condo intimidation. The riot, which soon became a high-water mark, had little to do with a curfew or park. Sweat equity and homesteading aren't as chic as bonfires and bottle throwing. The riot's just a peek of what the future will bring as the pendulum now begins its long downward swing. And the third is basically an excerpt of things that I kind of heard that I kind of turned into a little And this is number four, The View Stew. Whose fucking park? Our fucking park. No, everyone's fucking park, even the yuppies. Die, yuppie scum. Remember Lincoln Swatos. Who gave you exclusive rights to East Village? Squatters' rights. Squat shit. They treat the streets like a sewer. I've lived here all my life, and this park is a park. We need a shelter. The poor should get free housing. Larry Davis had a right. Screw the poor. The middle class should get decent housing. The problem is Japanese investors. No, it's not. It's Koch. It's the capitalist system. Oh, go burn a freaking flag. The strategy is all wrong. We need a list of demands. Remember Eleanor Bumpers? What year did you get here? Who put you in charge? I'm for the homeless sleeping in the park, part of the park, but against the Jersey punks who hang out there. Remember Michael Stewart? That guy's undercover. Those guys are undercover. Christodoulou is a horror. Remember who? It was better in the 60s, broadcasting live from Tompkins Square Park. Take a photo of that. I guarantee it'll make a cover. That's it.
Could
How
you?
The neighborhood? Yeah.
Yeah. That's
okay.
Good.
All right.
Introduce it.
Okay. This is another poem that tried to capture the feel of the neighborhood at the time, and let me kind of clarify that. If back in the 80s, if you went down Second Avenue between like St. Mark's down to 7th Street and that area, you would have a difficult time walking because it was crowded with people who basically would put out their stuff. And they would sell it. It was kind of this grand bazaar market of resold stuff. And I won't say any more. I'll let the poem describe the rest. The title of this poem is East Village Remains. Last night in East Village, the garbage was tossed out, only to wash ashore on Second Avenue, resold by peddlers, bought by the hopeless few, who see a nostalgia, a bargain, who take it home, try it on, or plug it in, only to find it's irrevocably broken and throw it out again, and reclaimed again by those who mine the garbage cans, eventually impounded, set free, abandoned, rediscovered, strewn and reshoveled into garbage trucks under police escorts. And what falls between the gutter and the sidewalk is yet reclaimed. Things don't go quietly in East Village. They return kicking and screaming. Everything that ever was still is lurking here, either in someone's home, a peddler's shopping cart, a filthy sidewalk, or in a garbage truck under police escort. At the end, they actually would have garbage trucks with the police that would come and kind of clean up the streets. So it would kind of take all these poor people that spend all that time would suddenly lose all their stuff. So this is the Tompkins Square cycle. Okay. And again, this is my first reading of this. I haven't looked at this stuff in 30 years, so...
Just announce it again.
The Tompkins Square cycle. Number one, an archetype. A tribe in New Guinea has an unusual way of finding its spring sacrifices. They still practice this today. No volunteers are requested, but all the warriors meet on an empty field and huddle in a loose pack, probably motivated as much by the zeal of witnessing violence and the collective might as celebrating fertility and the religious rite. Certain designated warriors ride among the fray on horsebacks and hurl dull-tipped spears randomly all day. Soon the event becomes frenzied, and when one of the spears imperils a warrior, the gods are paid, the event curtailed, the sacrifice made. Long after the riot, among those made aware, behind central booking bars, in a gurney or wheelchair, they might have all thought, shit, we paid much more, but could have each answered differently if asked about what for. That was the first part. Okay, part two, police strategy. After the cavalry and chopper and the wounded were taken away, people shocked, angry, curious, returned to Avenue A. Between 6th Street and 5th Street, they began to rally, swarm, and rant. Then someone would toss a bottle, and the crowd would retreat, recant. The police's turn came, advance, clearing the avenue down to 5th Street and pushing the mob to Avenue B and 1st again. Then it was their turn to retreat to 1st position along Avenue A and 6th Street. A Tompkins Square dance. Slowly, timidly, protesters would return to the front line, and gradually the pot would boil again, and someone from behind would throw a bottle into the garrison. That became the all-night continuum. Subsequent riots took more nerve. They encircled the crowd, undercover boys, busloads of reserves. And once the leaders were quickly shanghaied, they learned you just had spectators along for the ride. And then number three, pendulum swings. After the mid-70s, when the city came to the bankrupt extremity due to years of mismanagement, Lindsay's self-aggrandizement beams in activity. Koch and his early craft set the pendulum the other way. But like every dog, real estate developer, banker, landlord had their day. They waited and aided for what incentives enticed. Yuppie crusades, an eventual housing crisis, relaxed, reckless, slightly suicidal, out of touch, artistically idle, once components that made the East Village soon attracted those who would pillage. From parents to dorms to renovated flats, destabilized apartments that once had rats. Initially, they performed certain duties. They filled the coffers and made big booties. And by the early 80s, they saw their own debts and the epidemic of illegal sublets. Landlords hiked rents to the great outback. And longtime families, Puerto Rican, black, whose rundown apartments were rent-controlled, didn't suspect they lived in gold. For nickels and dimes and evacuation, the later ones collapsed to condo intimidation. The riot, which soon became a high-water mark, had little to do with a curfew or park. Sweat equity and homesteading aren't as chic as bonfires and bottle throwing. The riot's just a peak of what the future will bring as the pendulum now begins its long downward swing. And the third is basically an excerpt of things that I kind of heard that I kind of turned into a little... And this is number four, The View Stew. Whose fucking park? Our fucking park. No, everyone's fucking park, even the yuppies. Die, yuppie scum. Remember Lincoln Suados? Who gave you exclusive rights to East Village? Squatters' rights. Squat shit. They treat the streets like a sewer. I've lived here all my life, and this park is a park. We need a shelter. The poor should get free housing. Larry Davis had a right. Screw the poor. The middle class should get decent housing. The problem is Japanese investors. No, it's not. It's Koch. It's the capitalist system. Oh, go burn a freaking flag. The strategy is all wrong. We need a list of demands. Remember Eleanor Bumpers? What year did you get here? Who put you in charge? I'm for the homeless sleeping in the park, part of the park, but against the Jersey punks who hang out there. Remember Michael Stewart? That guy's undercover. Those guys are undercover. Christodor is a horror. Remember who? It was better in the 60s, broadcasting live from Tompkins Square Park. Take a photo of that. I guarantee it'll make a cover. That's it.
After the riot, Police Commissioner Ben Ward would issue a scathing report, laying the blame for the riot on the police. That police actions were, quote, not well planned, staffed, supervised, or executed, which culminated in a riot. Ward announced the retirement of Deputy Chief Thomas Darcy, who was absent from the scene and derelict in his duties. Deputy Inspector Joseph Wardarski, the senior officer at the scene in Darcy's absence, was not demoted, but he was transferred from his prestigious post as commander of Midtown South to a less sensitive command. Captain McNamara, the lowest-ranking commander on the scene, was temporarily relieved of his post, but was then allowed to resume command of the precinct the next year. A city review of the riot turned up numerous problems with the police department's actions, including a failure to contact either Commissioner Ward or Mayor Ed Koch. In the middle of the riot, the commander actually left the scene to go to the bathroom at the station house, which was several blocks away from the activities.
The whole riot and what happened to Paul Guerin, the videographer, and myself became a big issue, you know, with the police attacking us. And that attack was sort of at the apex of the riot, because he had caught a lot of it on his video camera. Eventually, you know, the assistant district attorney's office reviewed it, pursuing a case, I was interviewed by the Civilian Complaint Review Board. I was a young guy. I didn't really know the ins and outs of these things. I had a photograph of this massive bruise on my leg. I never showed it to them. I didn't trust them. Perhaps it would have been better to. I don't know. And in the end, there were criminal charges brought, as I recall, to the best of my recollection, against the officer for the assault on Paul Guerin. And they didn't bring charges against the officer for the assault on me. I was a witness in the case. It was a non-jury trial, and the officer was found not guilty by the judge. So that ended the criminal phase.
Fish for the plastic ocean. Zombie apocalypse. How do we get out? Where do we go? Where do we go?
For many present, the police riot had a significant impact on our perspectives about police abuse of power and also the power of community activism. While it may not have been a perfect response, the Lower East Side rose up to resist efforts at gentrification in an effort to save its open spaces, community gardens, homesteads, local businesses, and the very culture of the community. Fortunately, pockets of the Lower East Side culture of resistance still remain. Thank you to community activist Susan Howard, photographer John McBride, and writer Arthur Nersessian for participating in this show.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.
We are here. We are here.